George Friedman, founder and chairman of Geopolitical Futures. We hope he's with us. There he is. Hi, George Friedman. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. You know, we know this pandemic could prove a deeply destabilizing factor, not just economically, but also geopolitically. Where do you see areas of concern, you know, for areas where there may be serious change on the horizon?
Well, we've been undergoing change ever since 2008. What the coronavirus has done is accelerated and intensified some of the processes that are already in place. So China was already staggering economically and particularly hit by the U.S. sanctions. Now its largest customer, the United States, is in deep recession, not able to buy its goods and not trusting China. Russia was already in an oil crisis. Now the price of oil has evaporated, its ability to function limited. Europe has been fragmenting. Brexit has taken place, tensions within the European Union are there. Now they've come to an increasing point where, for example, the Italians and the Germans completely disagree on what needs to be done. So I don't think this coronavirus has changed the trajectory of the world. It has speeded it up. We're seeing crises all over the world that were endemic, but now intensified.
Okay, but it sounds like the most powerful countries in the world are facing obviously serious challenges, but it doesn't really change their ranking, so to speak, because people are talking about this whole new world order, but it sounds like the order might still remain the same, albeit with weakened economies and power.
Well, I don't see how China sustains its economic position in the world. It's not simply a question of challenging the United States. I mean, it was badly hit by 2008. It's an export-oriented economy. Exports dried up. Now exports are paralyzed. So the question is, how far down does China go? How far down does Russia go when oil, its primary commodity for export, goes away?
But I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just have to ask. I mean, won't the oil price bounce back though once you know the economy starts, industry starts moving again?
Well, if you think that, then I hope you buy oil. But it's no one knows if it'll bounce back.
We all do. If not directly, we are all consumers of that oil via our industries.
Russia needs $70 a barrel oil to balance its economy. It can get by with 40. It's the amount that oil has to improve is 3-4-fold to make a difference. This is a secular shift in the nature of the oil markets, driven in part by the development of American, United States as an oil exporter, but also driven in part by the efficiencies that have developed in the economy. So this is not a passing thing that's simply the coronavirus. It is something intensified, but I think the world order is changing, that a lot of countries that appear to be emerging and challenging for the top position have now been badly weakened.
Interesting.
And that is a change.
I need to address something else with you. I mean, when we look at history, and I said really our only reference point for this, it's economically, it's getting to be the Great Depression. We are seeing that level of poverty now, joblessness. And what reignited the economy in the wake of the Great Depression was, of course, war. You have certain leaders now, very powerful leaders, not least, you know, in the United States, who might be looking for scapegoats or to divert attention. Should we be concerned on that front? Might we see powerful people get reckless?
Well, powerful people didn't get powerful because they were reckless. We like to think of them as that. And every leader is trying to find someone other than himself responsible for this, and no one is. But we have to distinguish between what a recession and a depression is. A recession is a cyclical event, primarily financial. A depression is when the economy itself is destroyed. The businesses are gone permanently. Jobs have disappeared. Food is not available. This is not yet a depression. And in benchmarking it, we should draw that distinction. It may become one if this isn't solved soon, but I'd look very hopefully at some of the medical developments that have been made in the United States, Europe, and China, that we may find a mitigation to this before we go into recession. So I think we have to be very careful not to overstate what's going on. It's a terrible thing. But if you look at the Great Depression, it was horrible. This is not yet that.
Okay, but I mean, your hope is that medically the situation will be solved in time for it to become a Great Depression. So we really do have to pray that a vaccine does become available, or else this could sink us into the same position we were in the 1930s.
It doesn't have to be a vaccine. It can simply be something
more effective
like
treatment.
That will make it better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, though, about, you know, something we're seeing, and we were just talking about South Africa there. You know, we're seeing up to 4-kilometer lines of people just waiting for food because they can no longer feed themselves or their families. Food security was becoming an issue, particularly in the developing world, even before this pandemic. Do you think we are prepared as a global society for those kinds of shortages? You know, even in the United States, when we're looking at the president insisting that meatpacking industries stay online, even while there's a huge risk for their employees, they need to ensure that food is delivered and deliverable to people and still affordable. Is that being managed to make sure that a true crisis in food doesn't break out?
Well, I'm very cynical about this idea of a global community responsible. Each leader is responsible for his own country. South Africa has gone through a very difficult time leading up to this and therefore suffers greatly. But South Africa, I think, also has an opportunity here, having faced the abyss, to pull itself together politically, socially, and economically and say, it can't be like this. But the problem with much of the developing world is it's waiting for somebody from the outside to come and solve its problems. And by now, this far after decolonization, we have to face the fact they're not coming.
Okay. I do have time for one last question. So I just want to get your final outlook for the United States. You seem, as I said before, that you know you think a medical solution to this will come sooner rather than later. Are you optimistic then about the U.S. economy, not just pulling itself up, but if it does, therefore pulling up the rest of the global economy because it is the number one top consumer on the planet?
The United States is going to go to 2-3 very difficult years. But firstly, it is consuming its own products, and that drives its economy. And unfortunately for the world, the way it will solve the problem is by decreasing imports. And that's a problem for other countries that export to the United States. But the United States, make no mistake about it, is going to go through a economic crisis of significant proportions, if not a depression, but also a political one. We have an election coming. And in this election, there is deep social division in the United States over what should happen. And this will become a very tense period in American history.
George Friedman, great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, George. George Friedman is with me, Strategy and Future and Geopolitical Futures. We're discussing COVID and the future of the world. Hi, George.
How you doing?
Yeah, fine. So before I switch on recording button, we started discussing the future and what the COVID is actually. It's like a warfare. If you just could add to what you told me on the off mode.
World War One was massive destruction of capital, of everything in Europe. Not only to those who were destroyed in World War One, for example, but also those who won had to divert so much of their economic resources away from consumption to production that at the end of World War One, everybody was in depression. No one ever came out of it completely. What it produced was people who didn't know what to do with it. The British, for example. Those who did, Hitler, Lenin, they didn't do it well, but they thought they knew what to do, okay? Then after a prelude, the Second World War came and created a global depression. Japan was in utter depression. China, Europe, only the United States profited from the war. But that's the important point. The COVID comes along. And not by warfare, but by forcing us into our homes, into hiding, if you will. Okay. Economies are not collapsing yet, but declining at dramatic rates. Today in the United States, the price of oil went negative. This meant that you had to pay someone to take it from you. There was so much oil that the cost of storage had gone out of hand. Well, this is not OPEC warfare, but it is the massive dislocations that warfare causes to the winner and the loser, whoever else. So we have to think of COVID as a medical event, but we also have to think of it as, I thought of 2008 as kind of the critical point in the transformation of world economies, people going into nationalism, supply chains breaking down. I realized that wasn't it. This is it.
True.
This is where an entirely new international order emerges. First, by the amount of damage done by the COVID relative. Second, by recuperation, how will they do? Third, by watching the rise of nationalism everywhere. The Germans have decided that they're Germans and not Italians, and they're not going to give what the Italians need. And the Russians are staggering under the price of oil because it is critical. China is pretending not to be as badly hurt as it was. The entire world political order is shifting, including a massive, maybe recession, maybe depression in the United States.
And what is the center of gravity? Because what is the tool? What is the measure? How should we calculate the time to mitigate the medical crisis? You mentioned the decline of the economy. What is the infection point? What is the point where there is no return in a way?
Well, there's always a return. It's just a generation. So let's talk about the difference in recession and depression. A recession is basically a financial event. It's a part of the business cycle, and it moves the economy and takes out weak elements, and then it recovers. And it's a normal thing. It's unpainful. A depression is a destruction of the productive consumptive cycle, where the producers cannot produce for physical reasons, where the consumers cannot consume for financial reasons or physical reasons, where unemployment has reached such a state that the economy cannot reabsorb the people. So the issue is, are we in recession or depression? To which the answer in the United States, at least, is we're still in recession, but don't push, because very quickly, the supply chain, which is very complex and rooted in China in many cases, can become unmanageable. In one scenario, in 2 or 3 years, we recover. In the other scenario, as of the Great Depression, a generation is lost, trapped in hopelessness and helplessness. And this is when figures like Hitler or Mussolini or Lenin can arise. Explain to them that this war was caused by such and such, and you're suffering from this disease, and these are the people who are to blame, and let's move on. So there is no solution for these, but those who pretend they can solve it become very powerful. And that's where danger really comes in that political sphere.
I'm also of the opinion, based on what you're saying, is that also the international order usually tends to be at a critical point, not exactly when there is a rising power and a declining power, but when there is an inflection point that all parties involved, and also the middle powers, do not know where the trajectory will take them. That was exactly prior to 1914. So then they misjudge the situation and miscalculate their actions. And that might create chaos and also military confrontation.
Their primary problem was they did not understand the state of the military. They thought of war in a Napoleonic sense. They didn't understand that war had become different, and they didn't adjust to it. In World War II, the players understood that war had changed. They were either taught the lesson at Pearl Harbor in the American case, they had learned it beforehand in the German case. But what was interesting was that the victors were those who learned the fastest, who understood what had happened the fastest. In this particular case, it's not a war. What have we learned? Well, we have learned at least this much, that first, we are highly vulnerable to something we didn't anticipate. And two, an interesting question that will arise. Many died from the virus, but the death rate was perhaps 2-3% of those affected. I don't know what the number is. The government policies in all countries, it didn't matter what happened to the economy. There's only one goal: making sure everyone was safe. In war, there's calculated risk. You know that you can't do it. In this case, there was no calculated risk. The Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. Now, this is important, and there's a military aspect to think about this. We have to develop a vaccine and medicines for this. The timeline of the medical system and the timeline of the economic system are completely out of whack. The doctors say, well, in a year and a half, we can have something. And the answer is, well, in a year and a half, we'll own your house. You know. Now, there's something that's interesting that's happening in the United States. That there's a place called Fort Detrick, which is where biological research takes place by the Americans. It's in Frederick, Maryland, and it's a place where the primary focus has been on defending against biological attacks. Suddenly you see Fort Detrick involved in contracts with Gilead and all of the medical companies that are engaged in research. And with this, now we go from do no harm to carefully codified risk. So for example, a vaccine has been tested on two American soldiers. I'm sure they volunteered. They were very happy to volunteer. The point was, it worked. So when we think of the military, we think of calculated risk and time urgency. We think of the medical profession, both of those are alien. The Americans have added, and it's not clear to me, and I don't need to know, Fort Detrick into the equation, and suddenly we're moving ahead. So one of the things we're learning is, okay, as in war, you have dangers, and every act you take is dangerous, but not doing anything is the most dangerous. So the medical has to shift its gear. Now, in the United States, we're suddenly seeing all sorts of things that were not going to be possible for a long time being tested. We'll see how it works. And it's being tested with the knowledge that the person they tested on is a soldier. He takes a risk. You know, that's what they do. Have you seen any change like that going in Europe in the medical research areas?
Of course, I have no access to some classified information regarding that, but I would doubt about the efficiency of the European institutions doing that because of many, not only vested interests, but also all those rights, and also because of the attitude. I think that the last 30 years of the liberal West, especially in Europe, accustomed people to thinking that what they can demand from the politicians, the so-called of the strategy of annihilation, absolute annihilation of risk. So the politicians are culpable of any danger that materialized because they should have been annihilated the risk. When I think about the history of humanity, it has always been a calculated risk approach. And that drove us forward. We invented, we explored, we embarked on the world ocean revolution. Usually, and all, often, you know, after the great wars or during the great wars or during the great turmoil or revolutions or pandemia, that was happening. I'm also of the opinion, and I think that this will be a long-lasting impact of this pandemia, that in competition between US and China, we will go to the new heights, so the new domains where this competition will be taking place, because people would want to explore new domains, new economies, and military involved with these new economies. And over the last 2 weeks, I've been thinking heavily about this acceleration of competition between US and China on the back of pandemia and this global supply chain. And I think that also the race to the outer space control will accelerate. So I started thinking about this, we discussed that before, outer space, military warfare, and also the outer space as a terrain, military terrain with better and worse places, connectivity and locations, and you know how you move there, how you transport things, efficiency of that, and so on and so forth, and also the military aspect of that. So both the economy, new economy, and competition for that between great powers, because human nature tends to take sooner or later the calculated risk, because we are adventurous creatures and we are heavily competitive creatures. And we take this competition to the new realms, new domains. And outer space is the domain that is coming heavily, I think. Even if we are much poorer after pandemia, it will not matter that much, I think. That's my you know, rough first impression.
Well, at least in this, you weren't occupied by the Germans, and we didn't have to level Germany. In the United States, their first response was defensive. Now it's breaking down. The demonstrations have come up that we won't be sequestered. You know, let us, you know, we'll survive. Secondly, in many states, they never imposed any of this because the governors are more powerful and the presidents can't do it. Now the president has thrown in with those who are opposed to all of these defenses. We can move more quickly into a calculated risk mode, but Europe used to be able to do so. I mean, certainly one of the things it tells us is that the world is a dangerous place, which liberalism, if you will, taught that we were the dangerous by thinking it was dangerous. And so we've learned that there can be diseases, and that sometimes the price of defending against them is much higher than the price of enduring it. Or more precisely, she should have defensive measures available for intervention. So we've been speaking of cyber warfare, and I don't believe this is biological warfare. You can't aim the pistol. Don't shoot when the bullet comes back at you. And that's what we learned in all the research in this country. I don't think it was, but nevertheless, it originated, it came. And the militarization of medicine didn't happen for quite a while. By militarization of medicine, being told, this is your mission, this is your time frame, tell us what you need, but get going. For a very long time, it was the military. We have somebody here called Dr. Fauci, who was a very nice man, a very kind man, and we needed Curtis LeMay, you know, someone who could drive a bomber. And the two cultures met, and we are in the middle of an entente being reached between the two cultures. In this entente, the medical people realize they're not going to have a year and a half. The economy can't afford it. Get it done faster. Yes, some people will die, but they're dying now. What do you want? Okay. But also the entente between the American rebellious spirit, where Americans really are. You can't tell Texans, where I live, you can't get together. I mean, you can tell them that, but they weren't listening anyway. And then they staged a demonstration with everybody standing very close together in front of the governor's mansion. So there's forces that are unraveling in the United States in both directions. There is the European force that you described. The government's job is to prevent everything bad from happening to you. And if they don't, it failed. And then we have to be absolutely committed to safety in every way. To the other side saying, I can't live this way. I'm not going to live this way. I'll take the risk. The risk is fine. So I wrote one saying, look, I'm over 70. I can say this safely. I've lived a good life. I don't want to live the rest of my life hiding. And I'm concerned about my grandchildren. The only people who are going to really die are people who are sick and old. I speak for the old. I'll take the risk. Well, I got such letters back. How could you say such a thing? How could you possibly? The most precious thing is life. No, it matters what kind of life you're leading. And if the price you pay for living is a worse life there. So we in the United States are having that debate today. And the outline of it is very clear. And the Europeans used to have such debates.
Of course, in old good times, 100 years ago or even more. Yes.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But I look at the polls. You were occupied by the Germans and then by the Soviets. Nothing should frighten you. There should not be fear in your culture.
Of course.
And Poland is more than like that than the other countries, but still.
And I think we're doing fine in this pandemia, except that we observe the world changing. And increasingly, there has been an opinion that the European Union project is faltering, to put it mildly. South of Europe is openly criticizing the lack of solidarity from the North, especially the Germans. And the resentment is growing. There was no collectivization of debt. The Eurozone is structurally flawed in a way that it promotes German interests, and the Germans don't want to spend a penny to support it, so to speak. And this pandemia is really tearing Europe apart. And Poles see it. The problem is that it doesn't matter that they see it, because Poles always were sober about that. The problem is that we are not sure whether we have some other option on the table, except for joining the German zone of, economic zone, and sail along, so to speak. Because otherwise, there are voices here that we might not be confident about the US presence in Europe. China is coming and Russia is always here around the corner. So what should we do? And the fascinating philosophical tension that I can see in my fellow Poles is that we were dreaming a dream for the last 30 years. Really, we had a dream that after the demise of the Soviet Union, we finally arrived at the terminal point of history. After the just race to the West, the liberal democracy, and finally the freedom of strategic flows, freedom of movement, of traveling, of exchange, working. This is it. This is it. That's it. And that you don't need to make policy. You don't need to make history, because the environment is making it, because the liberal principles are so fine that they are doing it by themselves. And suddenly we have a major wake up here. Actually, we've had it over the last 5 years, that this is not the end. It was just a bus stop, a nice one in a nice weather in the nice European continent. Everything was nice. The sun was shining, and now it's cloudy. And we're back to our history. And we need to rise to the occasion.
I wrote a book on this, where basically I warned that Europe doesn't ever change, just imagines it changes. Look, 1848 was a great moment of Europe. It was the moment when nations were declared. It was a moment when the nations that had been submerged emerged. World War I was based, relied on these nations. It had a very different orientation. It was that these nations were weak. What I think the Europeans must understand is that you are a nation, and you may believe you're not, or something has happened, but you're a nation. And a German is not an Italian, and the German is not going to apologize for that. And the Italian is not going to apologize for being a German. And each nation must care for himself. That was the price you paid for 1848. The price that was paid for the rising was when you emerged into your nationhood, now you had to pay the price that came with that. And when the first thought becomes, who shall I ally with, you now begin the illusion again, that somewhere there's a safety that someone else will provide me, relieving me of the burden of doing it myself. You and I disagree on the danger from China. That we can always discuss. The Russians aren't coming. They can't find the keys to the tank. And the Americans, yeah, we have our interests. We're not ashamed. We are not indebted to Europe. We owe you not to harm you, but it's your business what you're going to do. But in the entire discussion of the liberals, it is always, who will protect me? Who can I go to that will protect me? And the answer is, and this Poland knows better than any nation in Europe, only Poland can protect Poland. You can have allies. You can have friends. You can go to parties. You can do everything you want. But history doesn't change. The defense of the nation is by the nation itself. And this is why Europeans called Americans cowboys. Because we knew this. Because we knew that in the end, there was no one we could count on. But it isn't even true for the United States because we're not in danger. But you're the smallest continent in the world after Australia. And you have 51 different nations in this very tight space. And European life was and is a zero-sum game. If somebody else has something, it must be from somebody else. And none of you are valuable enough that someone would want to own you and take care of you. They might want to own you and take from you, but there is no protection. So I think not from the virus, but the way from the EU and the way it responded to the virus, it's the end. Any idea that there's a European identity that transcends who you are is nonsense. The Germans know that. The difference is that underneath everything, the Germans always knew that. It was everybody else that was deluding themselves. As the Germans built their strength and built their authority, everybody else in Europe tended to believe, oh, this was just accidental. It was not anything planned or thought out by the Germans or any such thing. It just happened. But they were all Europeans. You're all Europeans. That means that you all are violently murderous people. That is your history. That is your heritage. And you wanted to leave it behind, but you can't. And that comes out, I think, of this.
But if we, yes, if we follow this description, and that might mean that the future will be very grim for Europe because of its deficiency in demographics, its heavy reliance in terms of the Northern European countries, the engine of Europe, on the export, if we have hard decoupling from China, if we have the hard decoupling from this globalized trading order, then Europe doesn't have any leverage. It doesn't have the Navy, doesn't control the lanes of communication, doesn't have markets if they are not secured by other power. It's not the island. It's being penetrated from the Russian side, from the Levant and Middle East, from the Mediterranean. It doesn't have the power projection capabilities on its own. It doesn't control the buffer zones on its peripheria. And also, it's increasingly, it doesn't have the top-notch technology that the US and increasingly China are going to field. And you know, the geopolitics is one constant, in my opinion, feed for modernization, because if you don't modernize your society and in production, your creativity, your innovation, then someone else is knocking on your door and say, okay, the game is over. Okay, so Europe is not, Europeans are not ready to face this. Today I finished the article about it, that within the exactly 10 years, as little as 10 years, this feeling of pride that we are post-politic, very modern power in the world, without the army, but full of ideas, we are declining into potential protectorate of either US or maybe even China.
We don't want you to be our protectorates. Go look. The crucial thing, there's no such thing as Europe. You keep referring to Europe as if it were a political entity. It is geographical. There was never a time in Europe where all the nations are equal. There was a time in Europe when there weren't weak nations and stronger nations. And when I look at Poland, and I've written on this, of course, I was looking at this. This came faster than I thought. But what nations have the courage and the national identity to create the resources that they must have, to change the meaning of the North European plane? The Germans can, but even they have bad memories. They will not do it. It is each nation itself. So I don't think a discussion of Europe this or Europe that has meaning.
You see, I'm just following the pattern.
What the British will do now. Yeah, I mean, look at Britain. By the way, did you ever hear of Brexit? It was in all the newspapers once.
Yeah.
Well, it's gone. The British saw something nobody else saw. This doesn't work. And it was the British people, not the elite. And no matter what the elite did, they couldn't get them to change their mind. Because they understood that when this came, and they didn't know it was going to come, but when this came, the Germans wouldn't be there. Germany would take what they could. But that's Germany, and that's fine. That's who they are. Know who they are. Do not pretend that you are the same as them, because they know better. And knowing what they are, you can make preparations. I have confidence in Poland. Because it was occupied by the Germans in the bloodiest occupation imaginable, then by the Soviets in what was not so bloody but was still long and terrible, 30 years didn't cause you to forget. 30 years was not long enough. There are not those alive who don't remember at least their fathers or grandfathers' stories. Yeah. And also, you have one other advantage. You're not stupid enough to believe it can't happen again.
Speaking on that note, George, it might be interesting for our viewers and listeners to state that the place where I'm sitting right now is 35 kilometers from the Hitler's field headquarters in the former East Prussia, the former German territory, nowadays in northern Poland, on a beautiful lakeside, heavy forested. And I'm 45 kilometers from the Russian border with the Kaliningrad enclave, right nearby to the Suwałki Gap, which is this, lane of passage to the NATO troops trying to support the Baltic states. So I'm in a very pivotal place that changed hands in history many times. Exactly, I'm in the middle of the Stahnenberg battle in 1914, where Germans defeated Russians, but at the same time that stalled them on, you know, I mean, Marne, miracle could happen because they were involved here. So this is it. The cemeteries are here, German and Russian soldiers. The Napoleon marched also here, north, to face the Russian troops from Warsaw in the winter campaign of 1806-07. And then the Grand Army also marched there 6 years later and brought a lot of diseases, by the way, to the nearby town. So this is a very, you know, you're in Texas and I'm in the middle of Eurasia.
So let me tell
you. Mackinder Heartlands, door to Heartlands, you know, to the place where the history was made.
So I live 20 miles away from the Alamo, where the Texans were massacred, but they faced the Mexicans. And they marched, the Mexicans marched to Houston and were defeated by Sam Houston. And if they'd beaten there, they would have taken New Orleans and choked the country to death. Instead, we tore northern Mexico away from Mexico, out to California, out to Arizona, New Mexico, and we secured our dominance of North America first by taking their land, of which no Texan is even slightly apologetic, you should know, and secondly, by creating a permanently weak Mexico. So we are both speaking at historic places. You are at the continents that used to be the dominant power in the world. I am at the place where the continent that is the center of the world now exists. There was a time when the Europeans did not apologize for what they did. They carried out their wars, they conquered the world, they transformed it, they made history. Now the Europeans are shocked that the Americans do the same thing. Well, the dominant power always is the dominant power. And this is why we look at China differently. You look at China as a great power reaching out. We look at it as a pathetic, broken down place that will never endanger anything. So there has to be a confidence, a boldness in a culture. Risk-taking comes from the confidence that we shall succeed. Europe in the 20th century learned that it won't succeed. It's not true that it can't succeed. It learned that it won't succeed. Which is why I think it's so important for those countries that haven't learned that lesson to distance themselves from Europe. The great strength of Poland is its anger. The anger at what happened to them, the anger at those who didn't stop it. As the Jews say, never again. This is Poland's possibility. Now, to do that, you have to look at the disintegration of Europe and say, not who will protect us now. Say simply, well, I don't know who's going to take care of Belgium, but I'm going to take care of Poland. Poland was a great power once. It believes it's not possible. And I believed when I wrote this that it was inevitable. So what will happen is you are no longer comfortable in the EU. Nobody, no Pole can rationally be comfortable. Most Poles are waiting. Wait until it goes back the way it is, was. It's going to go back. Everything will be the same. It won't. This moment will never let it be the same again. And at a certain point, the Poles will have to face history, which they want to escape from, but they can't. And then the shape of Europe will start. I did not expect this virus to be a definitive event. I didn't expect it to come at all. But I never thought that the European Union could survive. I never thought that the nations were gone or that the Germans would help the Italians, because I saw them not help the Greeks. So the Wesen to Poland, and I mean, this is my profound belief. When Poland comes to realize that no one takes care of Poland as well as a Pole can, and then it starts building, it is in the geographic position. You know, we talk about the geography of space, which is very important. But I see no reason why Poland can't be a space power. Poland simply has to have the confidence. I live in a place called Hayes County. Hayes was named after the founder of the Texas Rangers, which, if you've ever saw the movies, didn't do nearly as much as the movie show. He came here. There was nothing but Indians. It was nothing but anything. He took the land. He made it his own. It's not a question of should he or shouldn't he. What else could he do? And this is, I see this as a moment where Poland in particular, and in a crazy way, my Hungary is also doing it, but it's hard to understand exactly how. But this is the moment for Poland to have the one thing that it showed all through the 20th century, courage.
Yeah, for sure, the world is changing. We're not sure which direction it will evolve.
You haven't decided yet which way it will evolve. That's the point.
That's the
you're waiting
stance I should have. I understand.
Well, this is the difference between Europe in the 19th century and Europe today. Europe did not say in the 19th century, "I don't know which way it will go." They said, "We're taking it this way." And this psychological break, which is so small and so enormous. Will Belgium take this? No, it's not even a country. Okay. Will the Italians? They had their moment 2,000 years ago. Behind the, and there's no country. The only countries that will do this are in the East. You know, the Serbs, the Croats. They've never forgotten any of this. However, Poland is special because of its size. But it's the same history. So never ask, we don't know which way it's going. I haven't decided yet where to take it.
It's a good moment to end it now and promise our viewers that we are going to continue this debate, especially that the world events are accelerating the change, and the change is always existent, but some moments are making it even faster. So thank you, George. And I understand we're promising our viewers that we'll repeat this sort of session, remote session from Eurasia across the Atlantic to Texas. So thank you.
Goeienaand, good evening, fellow South Africans. And I have a very simple message for the world. And that is that you do not want to repeat what happened in 1902 to the Boers in the concentration camps. And those concentration camps were controlled and run by the British. The children and the women, largely children and women, starved in their thousands. They had diseases. They died. No one came to their aid. Emily Hobhouse wrote about this, and the government in Britain just pushed it to one side as if it didn't matter. What is happening in South Africa at so many different levels, not just the farm murders, not just the home invasions where people are being killed now in their houses. It's happening in white squatter camps where children are literally dying of hunger disease is becoming rampant. Living conditions are awful. Now, the reason these white people are in white squatter camps is not because they don't want to work. It's because of a thing called BEE, or Black Equity Empowerment. Basically, what it means is that if you're white, you cannot get a job. That is basically what it comes to. And, you know, the mainstream media are a complete and utter disgrace. Whenever they talk about South Africa, they look at the general picture and they say, oh, but it's happening to the blacks too. You know, they're also in this terrible position. But guess what? I don't buy that. They don't have BEE working against them. They don't have a government that's refusing to support them with social payouts or social funding. It's, in fact, they do get a small amount, but it's so small it's insignificant. Whereas the black population get extra benefits, don't they? Not the whites. And what's happening as a result of this is you've got a genocidal situation happening right now. As you sit in your lounge, right now, there are tens of thousands of young white children starving in South Africa. Their parents are starving. Disease is becoming rampant. You know, there are a huge number of suicides happening now in South Africa amongst the white population. I have shown so many videos here, which you can see the contrast between the way the Africans go about their daily lives, and I'm talking about that video you just saw where a car broke down and you never saw a white person there, did you? And you never will. With a protest, you never see a white person there, do you? And you never will. The white people have too much pride. You know, they have a total different moral structure to the black population. And that is not a racist comment. That is a fact. It's a truthful fact. And the mainstream media have not got their friggin' lefty little heads around that point. And when the genocide happens to the white population in South Africa, it's going to be on your heads, believe me. It's going to be on your heads. I'm going to read you a report right now about what is happening in these white squatter camps, and it is just terrible. I will put below that the charity's bank details, so if you can support them, please do. They're not associated with Loving Life in any way, but they are a reputable charity, and they are supporting whites in squatter camps. I'll just read to you what's said. The Boere Gemeenskap Transvaal is continuing with their drive to assist South Africans being neglected in the white squatter camps. They're helping people because no one else will, and the mainstream media is not sharing the truth behind the crisis. That's exactly the problem. The mainstream media is, in itself, fake news. Please support this project to help out our white children, the poorest of the poor, crying for your help, as there is no government help. Winter will soon be on us, and any contribution will make a difference. Anything you have will be appreciated. Blankets, shoes, clothes, toiletries, and food. Cash donations will go a long way to in assisting this wonderful project. The bank details are at the end of this article. Please get involved. They can arrange collection of any goods. Let our voice be heard. Stop the discrimination of the poorest of the poor. They are also human. Squatter camps conjure up images of poverty, filth, and isolation for the regular person around the world. People often do not visit these secluded places, but please note that there is no time. There are urgent needs to attend to, and the destitute are forgotten. 100 people, one bathroom, and a shared kitchen equal a potential health disaster. A proud father, able to work and provide for his family, was suddenly without work. Desperation set in as he walks up and down the streets trying to find a job. People must realize that there is a real problem, and eyes need to be opened to the crying children who beg for a piece of bread. Hungry, sick, cold, and dying, helpless parents watch as their offspring suffer. Now, that's a reality check to the world. to organizations like CNN, MSNBC, the BBC, and I can keep on going, you all suck, and your reporters suck. You are a disgrace. Now, please remember to subscribe to be kept informed, and I will show you some images of what happened in the British concentration camps in 1902, and these images are disturbing. Please be warned about that. But they reflect the reality of what's happening behind the scenes in white squatter camps today. And this is because the mainstream media and the South African government are doing nothing to help these poor people out. All right, guys, take care. Have a good evening.
Nouri El-Roubini is a world-known economist. He helped foresee the credit crisis of 2007-2008. He is the host of NouriElToday.com. Thank you for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Great being with you today. Thank you.
So I want to start, Nouri El, with your current thoughts on just how bad this can go. I know you've written and talked at length lately about the components that could take this from recession to depression. As you consider those, how are we doing? How are governments doing? How is the reopening going? Are you worried that we're veering towards a bigger slump?
Well, there are three scenarios for how things are going to develop in the global economy, North America, this year. My baseline is one of a U-shaped recovery, where the recovery is going to be anemic, subpar, below trend, very anemic. The optimist and the markets, at least the equity markets in the US, are pricing in a V-shaped recovery with very strong growth in the second half of the year into next year. And of course, there is a risk of a L, of what I call a greater depression. That's my baseline for the rest of the decade, but not for this year. I think that our forces are going to lead us to a depression by the middle of the decade, but it's not the prediction for this year. Essentially, my view is that it's going to be a U because this is a global shock. Both households and corporates will have to spend less and save more. Precautionary savings are going to go higher. Income is going to be lower. And then there will be less capital spending both by the corporate sector and the household sector. They have to deleverage. For household, capital spending is purchase of new homes. So you spend less, you save more, you do less capex, there'll be a global investment slump, there'll be a global savings glut. That's a recipe for very anemic recovery of the US, of Canada, of the global economy.
So the one thing that I think sets you apart from many others, and that would include the vast majority of investors, is this notion that this is a crisis, that we all recognize that there will be a contraction. The question is how long and how deep related to this crisis. You believe that later in the decade is when there's a price to be paid, that this potential for depression and deep slump happens much later. Is there anything between now and then that we governments could do to stave that off?
Unfortunately, I fear that there are some major trends. And in a recent publication, I discussed what I call the 10 deadly D's. They're going to lead us to a greater depression sometime later in this decade. It's only a matter of when, not weather. And I think that even if we're going to do monetary and fiscal stimulus or reform, I think the train has left the station and the train wreck is a slow motion one. It's not going to happen this year, but we have fundamental forces like debt and deficits, both private and public, are going to lead to insolvency. Unfunded liability coming from demographics is going to become worse, and with all healthcare spending, we're going to have initially deflation and real value of debt is going to increase, and that's going to make more people more insolvent. Then we're debasing currencies by doing effectively quantitative easing of large fiscal deficits. That eventually, with negative supply shock, is going to lead to inflation by the middle of the decade. We have also the digital disruptions. If we're going to reshore economic activity from China and Asia to North America, we'll have to substitute labor with capital, and firms are going to have to cut costs to save more and spend less. And that's going to imply more automation, more robotics. We are in the process of deglobalization, of decoupling between US and China. We are seeing this democracy backlash people are becoming scared, they're becoming more populist, and you have authoritarian populist government coming to power all over the world. And we have also this duopolistic strategic rivalry between US and China. The Cold War between US and China is becoming colder. It's going to get very ugly. We have digital rivalries. Cyber warfare is going to get worse over the next few years. This is the way warfare is going to be. It's not going to be conventional wars. The enemies of the West and the US, whether it's China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, they cannot fight the US and the West with conventional weapons. They're going to use asymmetric warfare, cyber warfare, in a way of weakening our economy, society, politics, and interfere with the US election. And then finally, we have also these, what I call deadly man-made disasters. Pandemics and global climate change are not natural disasters. Even pandemics come from poor health condition, destruction of ecosystem, and so on, let alone global climate change. So you have 10 forces that are very fundamental, that existed even before this crisis, and each one of them, if you think about it, is exacerbated and accelerated and made worse by this crisis. And therefore, we're going to end up into a greater depression. It's going to happen this decade, and policies cannot do much about it, because actually the policies of more stimulus, monetary and fiscal credit and otherwise, are going to actually exacerbate the debt imbalances. They're going to exacerbate the debasement of currencies.
Yes.
And with negative supply shock coming from deglobalization, protectionism, and populism, and economic nationalism, that's going to increase the risk of stagflation, recession, and inflation down the line. Today, the risk is deflation. In a couple of years, we'll have risk of inflation, like we had when we had negative supply oil shocks in the 1970s. So we're seeing ahead a greater depression, I fear.
So then, I mean, as you note, many of those things would have been a risk, were already a risk. They are being exacerbated. I just want to focus on one of the Ds. That's one of the first, and that's the debt level. Personal and, of course, sovereign. We are in way over our heads. We were before this credit, before this great crisis. In terms of how we get out of it, is there a natural path that would resolve that? Because it doesn't seem clear with governments behaving the way that they are.
Well, in the last decade, debt levels went higher. Initially, the global financial crisis was too much private debt, and then we socialized the losses. There was a massive increase in public debt. Estimates are that public and private debt as a share of GDP is now 350 as of the end of last year, but this year it might be closer to 400. In advanced economies, it's 388, less than 300 in emerging markets. And in China, is also above 300%. So the debt ratio are going to become higher. In the last decade, what saved us was that while debt ratio were high, and there was a rhetoric about deleveraging, but there was not much deleveraging occurring, debt servicing ratios were low because we had short rates close to zero, if not negative, like in Europe and Japan, and we had long rates low. Now, again, the same thing is happening right now. The policies of zero policy rates or negative or QE are leading to short and long rates to be low, but they are low only for safe sovereigns and safe people in the private sector. You can have zero policy rates, you can have bond yields close to zero or negative, but credit spreads in the private sector of those that are highly indebted, whether they are households, corporate, large and small ones, financial institutions, banks, non-bank shadow financial institutions, and the country overall, those credit spreads can explode if you have a situation of excessive leverage. And we had an explosion of leverage in the private sector, especially corporates and shadow banks in US and parts of North America. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether bond yields are close to zero for safe governments or policy rates are zero, credit spreads can blow up. And if they blow up, you have a debt crisis. So now you have a deadly combination of rising debt levels, they're gonna explode, and you'll have now credit spreads much higher than before. Yes, some central banks are now buying corporate bonds, and not just investment grade. The Fed decided even to go into the risky junk bonds, but it's only fallen angels, those that were investment grade and now just below. There are tons of other firms that are deep into the junk bonds, and they're not gonna be helped by the Fed. They cannot be helped by the Fed. Just this morning, announcement of Hertz, major auto rental company, is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You have major institution, large and small, they're gonna go bankrupt. So we have a debt crisis gonna become explosive, and with demographics and more spending on healthcare is needed to deal with pandemics. We'll have unfunded liabilities from healthcare system that are unfunded, like US Medicare, mm-hmm. and most of the world that are pay-as-you-go. And then you'll have debt deflation because prices are going to fall in the short run, wages are going to fall, and the ability of people to service that debt is going to be reduced. That's what's called the debt deflation kind of a dilemma or scenario. So all right. these things are going to lead us to debt crisis over time.